Happy New Year. Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. A bit under the weather, but figured if I had the weekend to just hang out and do nothing, why not post another great lost show from 2005? Gerard Jones was an awesome creator who did things like The Trouble with Girls, some memorable Shadow stories, and a great Batman story as well. Back in 2005, Gerard published a book called Men of Tomorrow, which chronicled the history of comics. And as 2010 will be a pivotal year in comic book history, as Marvel, Disney, and DC and Time Warner move forward, why not look back at comic book beginnings with Gerard Jones? So I present this episode from December 12th of 2005, Gerard Jones on a very special Word Balloon. Welcome to Word Balloon. This is John Suntress. Gerard Jones has taken a familiar path, combining his ambitions to be a writer and his love of reading comic books. In the 1980s, he wrote for the fan magazine Amazing Heroes, then turned pro with The Trouble with Girls, the comedy action series co-created with Will Jacobs. He wrote such mainstream heroes and titles as The Avengers, Batman, The Shadow, Green Lantern, Prime, and The Justice League. He and Will Jacobs documented the 40 years between the Silver Age to the then-modern era in The Comic Book Heroes. He's returned to the subject, expanding his scope at both historic ends, from the medium's beginnings to today's mainstream media success in Men of Tomorrow, Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book, now in paperback from Basic Books. Is it correct to assume that Men of Tomorrow grew out of that book that you and Will Jacobs did back in the 80s?
Yeah, basically. I mean, that was the first time that I had thought of writing about my comic book passion. And what Will and I were doing back then was just trying to, you know, there were a lot of books then about Golden Age comics. There was the Steranko history and so on. And there was really nothing about the period of comics that we had grown up on and where our passions lay. So we wanted to fill that in. It was a little conflicted because we sort of wanted to do a history, and actually I wanted to do a history. Will was more interested in doing sort of a reader's guide, you know, a sense of what was out there and why it was good and what people could go looking for. And we never quite pulled the two together. But I kept being interested in the history, and I actually been interested in the history since I read the Steranko book back in 72 or whenever I got my hands on it. And as it was time, I just kind of began to think, well, their story's not told here. I think I can focus my historical attention better now, you know, as time went on. Especially having worked in the business for over a decade, you know, having written comics, I thought, well, I get how this works, and I'm hearing a lot of great stories from the old guys. I would like to try to make some sense of how it happened, how comics came to be.
What I like about the book is, too, that you tie the history of comics and really make it into a very specific creator story, focusing on Siegel and Shuster, the creators of Superman.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was very, I mean, that became an increasingly interesting subject to me. I had heard the usual version we hear of Siegel and Shuster's struggle, which is the version that Jerry Siegel himself kind of defined, the sense of the innocent kids who are exploited by the businessmen. And there's certainly a lot of truth to that. But with time, especially talking to people who've been in the business a long time and had known Jerry and Joe and had perspectives, there was something else to the story. And there was clearly a way in which those two guys could have gotten a better deal and failed to. There were places where they had obviously been doing okay, and then something had gone disastrously wrong, and that quality of self-destruction began to fascinate me. And that's when it really began to seem like a complete human story, and really almost like a classical tragedy. It wasn't just that they were young and exploited, because there were other people, even younger, who cut much better deals and did better in comics early on. You know, it was that sense of why these guys, why was it the guys who had created this brilliant creation, really, they essentially created the superhero, as we understand it. Why had they also been so unable to negotiate real life? Why had they made these mistakes, and what were turning out to be repeated mistakes, not just the original deal, but then kind of the inability to negotiate further with DC, even when DC seemed open to some renegotiation and so on. And that story really began to fascinate me, you know, that in a way, the same quality of intense dreaming and make-believe heroics that came out in their work was also interfering with their ability to work within what was a pretty tough cutthroat business. You know, that became, to me, not just the core of an interesting story, but was very revelatory about how this whole idea of superhero came to be and what comics and what superheroes mean to so many of us who are so devoted to them.
You do a good job of explaining, too, that properties were really packaged and sold to magazine distributors, and mm-hmm. and that, you know, the successful creators were also successful businessmen enough that, you know, they understood, you know, how to exploit their properties. And it seemed at the beginning that Siegel was the kind of guy that did get it, and that part of the proposal for Superman included, look how you can exploit this character, look how he can tie into advertising, and how he can be a licensed property.
Yeah, it's something that is, you know, even with the sort of research I was doing, there so many things about people that remain mysterious. And in a way, it's still sort of a mystery of Jerry that he did get it. Yeah, they were back in the late 35, apparently, they were doing sketches and suggestions for how Superman might be used on cereal boxes and pajamas and so on. But when it came down to selling the material, first they just sent the stuff in and cashed the checks without thinking about it. And then I've heard a couple of different sources now, people who insist that Jerry was told, you know, you really ought to get a lawyer to look at this stuff, and he refused. And then Joe basically was sort of following along, doing what Jerry did. It just seems to have been his belief, his desire to believe, that he could handle everything himself. He was a smart kid. I think he wanted to believe he was an operator. I mean, I say kid, but actually he was 23 when the Superman sale was being made. I think he really wanted to be a bit superheroic. He was filled with excitement that this project was finally becoming real and was making the big time. And I think he was also trusting. He was just one of these people who doesn't expect to be outmaneuvered or tricked. And he was dealing with businessmen who had come up from the garment business and the soft pornography business and the mobs and bootlegging. And, you know, these were people who, I think, we're not bad people, but we're just, you know, lived in a world in which you didn't offer your, you know, the guy on the other side of the table from you in negotiations, you didn't offer him any more than he came and asked for.
Sure.
And so I think Jerry just wanted to believe that his talent and early success and energy and brains would be enough to get him through. And, you know, hiring a lawyer was maybe a little too much reality for him. After a while, I think he began to realize that he was unprotected. There were all these Superman cartoons and books and clothes and so on coming out, and he and Joe were not seeing very much from them. And I get the sense of a very strong panic, you know, in the early 40s, and he realized how big Superman had gotten and how he really had no protection on paper. And unfortunately, when he got scared, he started to sort of lash out angrily, which made him then, you know, the view of him at DC Comics then became that he was kind of a problem employee, that not that he was a creator they should keep happy, but he was, you know, a squeaky wheel they would just as soon find some way to get rid of.
And this was around the time, obviously, of the 1948 lawsuit then.
Yeah, it took him a long time to actually get to that point. You know, in the early 40s, there's a period when Jerry was writing angry letters to DC saying, okay, where's my share of the money? And Jack Leibowitz at DC would write back and say, oh, don't worry about it. We'll take care of everything in time. You know, basic sort of stalling tactics. I mean, Jack was an accountant and wasn't going to write a check that he didn't feel he had to. And then Jerry went off to the war, went to Hawaii with the Army. And it was there a couple things happened. One, DC started giving scripts to other writers because Jerry was gone, and sales didn't suffer. I mean, the readers didn't seem to care who was writing the material, which was alarming to Jerry because I think then he realized that DC wasn't going to value his work or his name. It was just about the popularity of Superman. And another thing was that DC brought out the Superboy series, which Jerry had proposed and had rejected earlier, and then DC brought out later when they thought the market was right for it. But Jerry felt that this was, you know, they were essentially doing an imitation of his character, and he was getting no compensation, which was infuriating. And in the Army, he met a lawyer, a guy named Albert Zug Smith, actually a would-be producer. He did become a movie producer later, but he had a law degree, and he talked Jerry into believing that they could sue and get the rights back to Superman and so on. So when he came out from the war, there was another stretch of about a year where Jerry was trying to just argue D.C. into changing their minds and giving more money. But when that hit a wall, that's when they went to court. And that was actually disastrous for Siegel and Shuster because they got a concession on Superboy. They got about $100,000 for the exploitation of Superboy, but they did not get back any of the rights or any of the money that Jerry and Joe felt they were due. And at that point, DC fired them and took their names off the comics and began a rough stretch.
Yeah, they created Funny Man.
That was another, I mean, as the tragic dimensions of the story came clear, that was one of the things that became most poignant, was when they took DC to court and they knew that they may not be able to do Superman anymore, Jerry and Joe really wanted to create another character that they very much wanted to believe was going to be as big as Superman and was going to take care of them, and this one they would hold the rights to. But they came up with Funny Man, which was the idea of a kind of a circus clown who fights crime, had this big Harpo Marx horn that he honked and giant shoes, and everything he said was a silly pun or rhyme, and, you know, it was to try to come up with something really funny when you're desperate and you feel like you need it. Unless you're a comedian by training, it usually doesn't work. And unfortunately, it really was not funny, and it just did not work. But you can feel the sort of frantic need in Jerry and Joe for this thing to succeed. And nothing is less charming. You know, the best work, including Superman, tends to come from a place of confidence and freewheeling dreams and a belief that you've got something great here that you're just tossing out and see what happens. When you're frantic to make something work, when you're trying not to lose, that's usually when the worst work is going to come out, and that was Funny Man. Right around the same time the lawsuit was going against them and they were losing their Superman work, Funny Man also came out and pretty much immediately tanked, which found them... it found Joe out of work. Jerry landed on his feet for a while. He ended up editing for the Ziff Davis comics line, now long gone.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe, who was having eye trouble, who really needed to be able to hire assistants to work, was unable to come up with anything. And that was the end of Joe's comics career. And it was the beginning of a long decline for Jerry.
I always thought, until reading things like your book, that once they lost the lawsuit, that was the end of their association with Superman, and that was the case for Joe. But you point out that Jerry did come back, and it really isn't until we read things like that recent DC Showcase that released a lot of those late 50s Superman stories just a month ago, and we suddenly discover, or the novice discovers, that Jerry Siegel wrote some of those great landmark late 50s stories, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's amazing that he was able to come back and still, you know, after going through, you know, such garbage, come back and really write some great Superman stories.
Mm-hmm. He really did. And it was the Superman stuff from the late 50s and early 60s did it so interesting because it's so sad, a lot of it. It's so poignant. You know, the death of Superman and just, you know, the...
All the imaginary stories.
Yeah, there's that story where he goes back to Krypton and tries to save it, but gets destroyed again. And there's a sense of real doom and despair that is beautifully done for what they are. I mean, they were aimed at young readers, 6, 7, 8-year-old kids, and they were very storybookish. But there's a really fine handling of melodrama within that. Some of that, I'm sure, was coming from the editor, Mort Weisinger. But I think a lot of it was coming from Jerry himself. I mean, the pain that Jerry associated with Superman. Superman, to some extent, was born of Jerry's pain in that his father had been killed in an armed robbery when Jerry was a teenager, and I think Superman, this bulletproof crime fighter, came largely from that, a young man trying
wish
to
fulfillment. Compensate.
Yeah, wish fulfillment. But then when we get to Jerry Siegel in middle age, scrounging for work, having been on top of the world for a while with Superman and then being plunged into financial hardship and obscurity. I mean, I think there was an additional quality of loss and pain that Jerry must have associated with Superman, and it came through in the stories in a really interestingly refracted way. It's never, of course, directly about Jerry's struggle, but I think the ability to use Superman for tearjerkers was something Jerry brought. And, you know, those of us who knew that 50s and 60s Superman, and, you know, that really ran through it. It was one of the things that was interesting about Superman. It was so wholesome and simple in a way, mm-hmm. but there were so many stories that were so melodramatic and at their best could really kind of punch you in the gut. And I think there was a lot of Jerry Siegel in that. But then he lost that gig when he took them to court again.
So, yeah.
He didn't give up easily. He kept slamming when the Superman, when the Action Comics copyright came up for renewal in 66,
mm-hmm.
Jerry felt like he could fight again. Maybe he had a chance again to get a piece of Superman back, and that was the end of his second DC career.
Some people know about the fight to finally get Warner Brothers, Time Warner, to compensate these guys in the mid-70s as the preparation for the Superman movie happened, and it was people like Neil Adams and Jerry Robinson that really mm-hmm. kind of took the cause. And you know, it did start with Siegel himself, though, kind of making that case and you know, hoping to get some sort of media attention of how poorly they were treated.
Mm-hmm. It's piecing together what happened. It's interesting always trying to piece together what happened with Jerry because he did mythologize. He did rewrite his own story, I think sometimes just to make it more interesting. I think sometimes strategically in order to seem like more of a victim, in order to keep the sort of good and evil story, you know, simple for his supporters and the press, I think he left some things out. Like the fact that he really was employed in comics pretty consistently till right around the end of the 60s, mm-hmm. and even in the early 70s was still selling some, oddly enough, Disney comics for the European market. He was writing for the English and Italian Disney lines. But he did reach a point. He had run out of all his legal options. He had taken a job at the Public Utilities Commission in Los Angeles, not a desk job, but usually delivering mail. He was like a mail clerk, you know, pushing a mail cart down the corridors, doing a little bit of writing, but not much anymore. In actually the paperback edition of my book that just came out, I was able to add some new stuff that wasn't in the hardback. The turning point seems to have been when a fan named Murray Bischoff, he and Alan Light were involved in what was the name of it then? Anyway, I'll look that up. But it was one of the big fanzines of the early 70s.
Okay.
It's embarrassing to suddenly be, you know, it's not the Rocket Splash. These things change their names, but it'll come to me. This found out that Jerry Siegel's last attempt to get a legal solution out of D.C. had failed. I think about the beginning of 1975, and it was Murray who wrote about that in the fanzine, and this set, I think, Shel Dorff, who was involved with the San Diego Con mm-hmm. at the time, to track Jerry down and make some contact with him. And there's also a guy named Chuck McCleary who contacted Jerry because he lived in the same building, apparently. You know, there was a sort of interesting coming together of fans tracking Jerry down in early 75. And it was that made Jerry realize that there might be people who would support him if he were to go public and complain about what DC had done to him. And that's when he started writing his famous press release, his 10-page, single-spaced retelling of his relations with DC. Very fiery. He started off with, "I, Jerry Siegel, co-creator of Superman, put a curse on the Superman movie," and went on to call Jack Liebowitz, the DC publisher, a money-mad monster who has wrecked my life. And so, you know, it's really good old pulp writing. And he sent out, by some estimates, he sent out 1,000 copies of that to every newspaper and magazine and radio show and TV show he could think of. And gradually in late 75, with the Warner Brothers Superman movie being promoted, that started to attract some attention. By the way, it was the Buyer's Guide for Comics Fandom with
okay.
the Alan Light, Murray Bischoff fanzine.
There you go.
So glad that came out. But, you know, once that started, once some publicity started coming out, you know, here was what had once been just little DC Comics, a little privately owned, kind of shady DC Comics, was then part of Warner Communications, a publicly held company that was trying to promote its Superman movie, and there was a degree of embarrassment about suddenly having these stories in the Chicago Tribune and the Washington Star and the New York Times about Jerry Siegel having been so mistreated by them. Then it started to get some TV attention. Tom Snyder's Tomorrow Show, I don't know if you remember that.
Absolutely.
Touched upon it and did it, and actually had Jerry and Joe and Neil Adams on. And at that point, the Warner's brass said, well, we need to end this bad publicity. And maybe there was even a sense of doing what was decent. You know, it's hard to tell what goes on in these discussions.
Sure, in these boardrooms, absolutely.
In the boardrooms, you know. Certainly the presentation, it was Jay Emmett, who was Jack Leibowitz's nephew and kind of represents, you know, in a way, the new corporate philosophy. Said, well, we have no legal obligation to take care of Siegel and Schuster, but there is a moral obligation. And at that point, they negotiated to get their credits back in the comics and get their medical bills taken care of and get a pension for life, which was something.
And yeah, something that really a guy like Joe Schuster absolutely could use, who was, as you say, too, was, you know, living with relatives and blind and just down on his luck.
Joe had fallen quite far down, and that was a huge, you know, at that point, Joe moved to Southern California to be near the Seagulls and had a social life again, and seemed to have enjoyed the last stretch of his life, which was something. I mean, they could have done so much better. Superman was so lucrative, but it was a moral victory, and it was better than where they'd fallen. Let's put it that way.
You indicate too in your book, in the soft cover version, that you know, now DC with guys like Paul Levitz running the company as publisher, you know, the Siegels and Schusters in 1999 have you know, kind of started the process again, because every 25 years they're under the old Copyright Act, and I'll let legal people or people interested really try and figure that whole mess out. But basically, the Joe Simons, the survivors of the Siegels and Schusters, are able to, after a period of time, each 25 years or so, are able to, you know, once again claim ownership and at least get, you know, if they're successful, 50% of the trademark of these heroes that they created. And you even say that at this point, too, that DC seems to understand, you know, and there really is no malice as there might have been during the Weisinger era or the Leibowitz era.
Yeah, it's such a different world. I mean, it was one of the things that became interesting to me about writing the book. It started as a more sort of a psychological story and a genre story, but I got increasingly interested in the business environment. Actually, what really kicked the book, what really made me take this book off just the list of things I might do someday and actually started working on a proposal was when Jack Leibowitz died in 2000. He was 100 years old. And his obit appeared in the New York Times, and it told a fascinating story of this kid who was born into poverty in Russia in the Pale of Settlement and came over at 10 years old, and his dad was a socialist labor organizer, and Jack became the chief accountant for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. It's a very, you know, very American story, but not one that would seem to lead to comic books at all. And then suddenly there's this shift to comics. And then, again, I had mostly thought of Leibowitz as the guy who exploited Siegel and Schuster, but he also turned into a great philanthropist. He virtually built a hospital on Long Island and gave tremendous amounts of money to the Anti-Defamation League and so on. And sounded like, in most ways, a very decent, fair guy, but of an older stripe, and really of that pre-World War II kind of businessman. And the more I looked into it, I could, you know, there was a huge shift between the Leibowitz who really seemed to take Jerry Siegel's complainings personally and really had this sort of clannish sense of, you know, you're in the family or you're out of the family, to, by the 70s, his nephew, Jay Emmett, who was one of the head honchos by then at Warner Communications, this much more sort of open, fluid, ethically relative, practical view of things. Well, you know, we need to think about our publicity and looking like nice guys. And it was just such a different corporate climate. And that became one of the running themes of the story for me, was how America had changed so much from the Depression to the 70s, and there was a kind of a little microcosm there of that.
You do a great job, too, of pointing out all the various players that fans probably weren't aware of. The fact that, you know, was it Shelley Mayer who mm-hmm. really convinced Leibowitz to buy Superman, or Donafield to buy Superman?
Yeah, it's hard to put. There's a couple of they're not competing stories because the guys were friends and they didn't really compete. But Vin Sullivan, who was a young editor, he was actually with Detective Comics before Leibowitz and Donenfeld picked it up, back when this very peculiar guy named Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson was running it.
Mm-hmm.
And then his friend, Shelley Mayer, who had also been with Major Wheeler Nicholson right before. And Shelley apparently liked Superman first and showed it to Vin, and Vin said, yeah, this is pretty good, and he got it into Action Comics number one. But it was very interesting because Jerry and Joe had Superman rejected by almost everyone they'd sent it to.
Will Eisner, in fact.
Yeah, even Eisner. You know, everybody who was trying, you know, a little bit older maybe, and not in the case of Eisner, he was actually a little younger than them. But, you know, most adult editors or people trying to sell to the market as understood then said, this is strange. It's just not developed enough. It's too silly. But it was these two kind of geeky young guys, Mayer and Sullivan, who seemed to get it. You know, they had the sense of, I think they knew why this strange character hopping around in tights and a cape would be appealing to kids, and got it out there. Although even then, it was kind of a near miss. I mean, it was the fact that Action Comics had to be assembled quickly, and they didn't have a lot of material for it, and Superman was already on the slush pile that I think made it all come together. Superman just seemed to be an idea that nobody could quite trust. I think it was just too unusual.
And Jack Leibowitz, an interesting guy, and you do tell his story very well. I thought that it was very forward-thinking, and granted, he had the experience of the success of the Superman radio show, mm-hmm. but that television show, The Adventures of Superman, the George Reeves 50s show, mm. was such a brilliant move by Leibowitz not to partner up with a network, with a film company that was looking to distribute TV, that he kept it in-house, that had to have made, you know, millions upon millions for DC.
Yeah, it was quite... He was a clever businessman. He was a forward-thinking businessman. One of the other interesting things I liked playing with in the book was that he had started, actually, as just the accountant for Harry Donenfeld, who mm-hmm. was a printing salesman, kind of dabbling in publishing in the late 20s, had made a bunch of money from bootlegging, had a lot of mob connections. One of these poker-playing, back-slapping, heavy-drinking, fun guys.
Sure.
You know, not a guy you would trust particularly, but a guy who apparently was always entertaining to hang out with. But his idea, once he got into publishing, it was, first of all, it was mostly girly magazines, and then these kind of sleazy crime magazines, a lot of true crime and so-called spicy detective. His idea was to create a whole bunch of little companies under different names at different addresses and dodge the tax laws, and really, you know, close to a fly-by-night.
But sure.
It was Leibowitz who saw, especially when Superman hit, that this could actually be built into something, and he set out to consolidate it into National Periodical Publications Incorporated and took it public and so on. He saw the TV was the happening medium. He understood that comics would suffer from TV and might not survive TV, and the key was to get his character out there into that medium, to get the character he owned, not that he created, but that he, you know, his company owned.
Mm-hmm.
And owned them themselves. They also, I think it was with the second or third season, went to color, even though color TV was not at all common. But Leibowitz could see that it was coming and that the rerun value, very few people in 1954 were really thinking about rerun values with TV, but he was one who understood that with a constantly renewing audience of little kids, Superman would probably keep selling in reruns, so he had them do color episodes that were initially broadcast in black and white, but when color kicked in the early 60s, there were suddenly color reruns available. He also found ways to produce it incredibly cheaply. He had it produced and story edited by Mort Weisinger and Whitney Ellsworth, two of his in-house people, so he could have them control the content. And there's a lot of stuff they do. Like, they would have all the scripts written before the season,
mm-hmm.
and then they would shoot every scene for the entire season in a particular set. So all the Daily Planet office scenes would be shot at once, and then, you know, all the catching a crook in an abandoned warehouse scenes would be shot at once, which the actors found frustrating because they could never get the sense of the story they were doing.
Sure.
But in the end, they got to cobble them all together, and it was an incredibly cheap product that generated a tremendous amount of money. And it's you can kind of see Leibowitz's training in the garment business there, you know, this whole kind of piecework, cut it and sew it, ship it out fast and cheap philosophy. But it worked.
No, it was brilliant. And it also kind of harkens to what they do today, obviously, when they film, when they make movies and they mm-hmm. shoot out of sequence. And it's funny, I've heard stories about shows like My Three Sons, Fred McMurray's show, that did the same thing to mm-hmm. accommodate McMurray's film career.
Yeah, he apparently had it in his contract that he would do his entire work for the season in about 4 weeks in the spring. So he'd show, yeah, they'd have all the scripts done. Same concept a little bit later. All the scripts written for the entire season, and then he would just sort of walk in, do his lines, and walk out. Everybody else would work for a few more months doing the scenes around him, which, you know, it worked for Fred.
Yeah.
Although when you see him, especially, I don't know if he did that in the first couple of seasons, but in the later ones, you do get the feeling that somebody has just interpolated these scenes from this aging, bored actor that have nothing to do with what's going on around. So,
I know you did your sitcom book as well.
Yeah.
So did My Three Sons figure into that book?
Yeah, I think I may have used that very detail when I was talking about how the, you know, TV production went from the wild early days to the sort of, you know, machine-driven 60s.
And, you know, the book, obviously, we're focusing on DC and Superman because, really, that's kind of, as you say in your narrative, that's really where everything started or really, mm-hmm. you know, took off. But you do tell all the background stories of the other publishers as well and various things that, you know, happened in history and how they affected the comic book market.
Yeah, I tried to touch on them at least. You know, I always kept an eye on Leibowitz, Sonnenfeld, Siegel, and Schuster, those that quartet was kind of the core of my story. But I did want to acknowledge that they were affected by things happening beyond them. So I do talk about the explosion of other publishers in the early 40s and all the stuff with EC and MAD in the 50s, which actually was quite involved with the story because it was Jack Leibowitz who ended up distributing MAD after mm-hmm. after it had run into trouble with the government and parents groups and so on. You know, it's a small community. Comics has always been a small family. Everybody shifts around and works for everybody else at some point, and it's interesting too to realize the extent to which the distributing arm of DC, Independent News, was involved in distributing a lot of their supposed competitors too. So, you know, there's a
including Marvel,
yeah. When the American News Company went bust, which was one of the big distributors, had once been the biggest. When it went broke in 57, it was Independent News, Leibowitz, that picked up the Marvel distribution. And created some interesting conflicts in the 60s because clearly Marvel was starting to surpass DC and force DC to change the way it did business, but it was actually, you know, the Marvels were generating profit for the same company, so it put them all in an odd place. See, some of these senses of, you know, the stories we tell ourselves as fans about these rival companies going head-to-head are a little too simplistic. The relationships are often much, much more complicated.
Well, and yeah, you had something unique, too, where Leibowitz, you know, might have been threatened by Marvel and what they were doing editorially, but he was able to control how many magazines they could actually put out mm-hmm. monthly, and that's why you had things like, you know, Tales of Suspense, which, you know, featured both Iron Man and Captain America, if it was
right.
Tales of Suspense.
Yeah, they were trying to increase their superhero line or their Adventure Comics line, but they could only do a certain number of titles. And it's interesting to go back and look, too, at how, say, a Millie the Model spinoff or a Western gets canceled and then a new superhero comic picks up. The number of comics produced by Marvel from about 57 to 68 is quite consistent, but to bring out something new, they'd have to kill something old.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look beyond just the superhero genre, which seemed to be exploding, in fact, their overall product was the same. But then in late 67, I think it was, Martin Goodman, who published Marvel, did break away from Independent News and found other distribution, and that's where you suddenly get the Marvel explosion, which, what was I, 11 when that happened? It's a pretty exciting moment in comics when suddenly there's a Mariner comic and a Captain America comic and all this other stuff coming out.
That's cool. I absolutely recommend the book. I think you did a great job. It reads well. There are interesting anecdotes, and you have that central narrative of DC and Siegel and Schuster, whose lives were obviously wrapped around the evolution of the comic book business from its start, and really you really take it up to the modern day.
Well, good. I sure enjoyed doing it. It was really fun to pull it all together.
Well, let's talk about some of your comic books, if we can.
Sure.
With the time we have left. I remember The Trouble with Girls.
Oh, good. Unless somebody does.
Well, it came at a great time. It came during that you know, inventive time in the 80s where, mm-hmm. where so much new product and new genres were being, you know, or I shouldn't say new genres. Everyone was embracing old genres again.
Mm-hmm. And startlingly new stuff, too. You know, you had Love and Rockets, which was like
absolutely
nothing I'd ever seen anywhere before. Yeah, that was a fun time. I mean, I had loved comics as a kid and a teenager, and even in the early 80s was getting reinterested in them as an adult. But it wasn't until somewhere in the mid-80s that the sense of possibility just exploded on us. I mean, I guess fandom is exciting for everybody involved in fandom, but you know, it seems to me that was a rare moment when anything could happen. You know, there were so many great non-superhero things like Love and Rockets, and so many spins on the superheroes like Zod and Nexus that were unlike what we've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you had the big, classy, kind of, you know, arty, intellectual reworkings of superheroes. You had Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen coming out at the same time, and that's the point when I really wanted to try writing comics. I didn't just want to be a writer of other stuff who liked comics as a fan, but I wanted to see what I could do. My friend Will felt the same, so we, you know, our approach to it was to do just sort of wide open, absurd, character-driven humor, which is where Trouble with Girls came from, which is still my favorite. I think my favorite writing project ever, and it was the most fun I ever had as a writer.
That's cool. Yeah, it was a comedy adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And it was. It was, you know, kind of a little bit of a James Bond feel to it.
A little bit, yeah, but it mostly revolved around some very strange characters. You know, Lester Girls' belief that he would be happy if he could just marry a nice plain girl and live in a bungalow in the suburbs, not have all this stuff happening to him that he seemed unable to get out of doing. And his, you know, his various weird and obnoxious friends and the sort of foster children he had. And it was just, you know, we just made up a little repertory company and just took off with it. And, it seemed like there were no restrictions or bounds at that moment in comics. Ultimately, you know, the market got a little more restrictive again. Lester didn't make it into the... When did it die? About 93, I guess, sort of during that period when Image and Valiant were defining everything that comics should be. I guess they've opened up a little bit since, but I remember the frustration of those years. It seemed like no one wanted anything at that moment, unless it felt like an Image-style superhero.
And, you know, I wonder if you would ever bring Lester Girls back, because, you know, honestly, I could see that lining up very nicely with the things you see from publishers like Oni, for example.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'd sure be open to it. Will and I haven't pursued it. We haven't sat down and, you know, thought, well, okay, how could we reinvent this for now or get ourselves re-excited about it? But the idea certainly crosses my mind. And I have talked to a couple people about possibly collecting the early ones in a graphic novel form, which hasn't come to be, but I think that's a strong possibility out there.
Good, because I've been trolling around looking for, you know, a copy somewhere, either on eBay or Amazon, one of the, you know...
Quarter boxes, yeah.
Exactly. Well, yeah, and, you know, it seems like... Because there was a trade, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were actually three trade paperbacks in the early going, although those are very hard to find. They had small print runs, and, you know, this is... God, it's a long time ago. 15, 16, 17 years ago. But yeah, there were the first nine issues were collected in three little books.
Yeah, okay.
But it would be great to, you know, to do. There's a lot of things like what Larry Young and those guys are doing at Planet Lar.
Sure.
You know, these nice big fat reprints. So maybe something like that can happen, and then see if we feel like the world is ready for new adventures of Lester.
You had a great run on The Shadow too.
That was fun. That was probably the most satisfying experience with this sort of straight adventure superhero-ish stuff I've done. I've always been fascinated by the 1930s, which helped with Men of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's about that. And I enjoyed... One thing I learned as a comics writer is I'm not good at comics that tie in too much with some big universe-wide continuity. You know, I have to focus on my storyline and tell that story. So The Shadow was great for that, because nobody was trying to guest star him with anybody.
Right, and you had brought him back to the 30s as well, mm-hmm. And that was coming off of Andy Helfer and Sienkiewicz, or Sienkiewicz rather, doing, mm-hmm. you know, following in Chaykin's footsteps and having the modern take on The Shadow.
Yeah, which was a fun series, but then there was a sense of, well, let's try taking him back again, and that was sort of my mandate. Let's, you know, go back to the 30s and do a sort of a straight Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Although then I got to spin it, you know, sort of into some of my own concerns, too. And really enjoyed working with Eduardo Barreto,
great artist
on most of them. And I enjoyed working with Brian Augustin, who was a new editor at DC at the time, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, eager to do fun stuff. So it was, it was a good experience. But then I, you know, it was once I got onto the other, like the Green Lantern and Justice League and so on, and it seemed as though I was always executing some storyline that had come from somewhere else, that, you know, nobody even knew where it had started in some cases, that I found I just didn't seem to be able to focus on the storytelling like I wanted.
Was Mosaic then something that was presented to you, or was that your idea?
That was what Andy Helfer, who was the editor of the Green Lantern line at the time, wanted was something unusual with Jon Stewart. He wanted to do mm-hmm. different titles. He wanted to do Hal Jordan, which was going to be the Green Lantern comic, and a Guy Gardner and a Jon Stewart. And we came down with the idea, came up with the idea of Oa being turned into this planet where lots of different races and creatures have arrived, and Jon has to try to, you know, create some kind of functioning social structure out of these different worlds. That was something Andy and I collaborated on. But then Andy actually turned those over to Kevin Dooley, and I really had a free hand for a while on Mosaic, which was fun for me. I think there were a few issues where I was really hitting something. I think it started a bit shaky, but there was a point there where I really felt like I was getting something right.
No, it was the closest, I think, that Green Lantern came to looking like a Vertigo book.
Yeah, and I think, ultimately, I think what caused it to be canceled was the fact that it was right at the moment when they were beginning to segregate the Vertigo stuff from the DCU stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Death of Superman was... I've lost track of the chronology now, but I know Death of Superman was in the background there somewhere. And
that sounds right.
So there was this sense that the DCU stuff should interrelate and it should all be a fairly reliable, consistent style. And the Vertigo stuff is the Vertigo stuff. And having a member of the Green Lantern Corps, a Green Lantern spinoff that felt Vertigo-ish, just didn't make any sense. I think, you know, a few years later they might have been more open to something like that, but that was a tough moment. A straight-up superhero who was weird in approach just didn't fit what they were doing. So, unfortunately, the sales were still good, but it did get canceled because it didn't fit the larger scheme. And that was disappointing, but, you know, it happened. This is a commercial commodity, and we fan writers try to breathe as much heart into it as we can, but that's really not what ultimately makes the decision.
And we didn't mention it. We've talked before, and we didn't mention it for this conversation. You, before starting writing comic books and stuff, you were writing Amazing Heroes, right? The magazine.
Yeah, that's where I was taking my fanishness. Before I was mainly a humor writer. I was writing for National Lampoon, and Will and I had done a humor book and so on. That was kind of my main career. But I loved comics, and around 84, 85, was getting very excited by the new stuff, and I believe it was when Mark Waid took over Amazing Heroes. He asked me if I wanted to write some reviews, which was really fun. I mean, that was a chance to really, you know, take the fan conversations I was having with my fellow comics aficionados and put them down on paper and get them out and promote some stuff that I was especially fond of. And I think I was a big advocate for Zot and Love and Rockets at the moment. And that was, let's see, I guess that was after Will and I had written the comic book Heroes. But
this was like mid-'80s, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it was, in fact, I was still, when the Trouble with Girls happened, I was still writing some stuff for Amazing Heroes.
Right, and that's probably where I heard it, of Trouble with Girls, and then, you know, went out to look for it, was after reading some of your reviews and stuff.
Good. Yeah, that was a lot going on at once, which was quite exciting.
Talk about your Lampoon-y years. I'm curious about that.
Well, Will and I wrote a book called The Beaver Papers, which was a humor book. Basically, the idea that when we were claiming that when Leave It to Beaver was canceled in 1963, the world's great writers and intellectuals rose up to try to save it. So we had these supposed scripts and treatments for Leave It to Beaver by Ingmar Bergman and William Faulkner and so on, which was really fun to do. But that caught the eye of Glenn Eichler, who was the editor of the Lampoon at the time, and he brought us in to do some stuff, and did that for about 5 years, pretty regularly, and did some other satirical stuff. I did some work for Paul Krasner's Realist.
Mm-hmm.
So, although I do have to say, writing short-form humor is exhausting. You know, having to keep producing...
Yeah, feeding the monster.
Yeah, yeah. It was a hard one. I don't know. It was sort of a relief to get to comics, because then the emphasis could more shift to storytelling, and the jokes didn't have to come so constantly, and, you know, not everything had to have a satiric structure. And so it was really fun for a while, but I don't think I could go back at this point to... being a regular satire writer.
Did you have an opportunity to work with some of the cartoonists, the comic book cartoonists that also worked at Lampoon? I know Russ Heath did a few things for Lampoon back in the day, for example.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question.
Or Drew and Josh Friedman, of course.
Yeah, there was some good art and certainly some good work in the issues I was in. I had some illustrated stuff in there. But I don't think it was in any. It was by any of the big name comics guys. Although there were, I did start to make some connections and get some name recognition from that. I mean, I began to, you know, kind of know these people secondhand.
Mm-hmm.
Had some, you know, passing acquaintance too with some of the guys, some of the early founders of the Lampoon, who were still sort of knocking around the office. This was mostly after the original guys had all gone off into, you know, film careers.
Sure.
And so on. But they were still sort of in and out. And, I was in California working long distance, but I went back to the offices a few times and got to know that. So it was interesting to be, you know, this was, what, 83, 84, 85, 86, right in there.
Okay, yeah, that was when I was in college, so I was reading the Lampoon back
okay.
then.
Yeah, probably read a few of them, I think. No, but it was, you know, it was this interesting feeling of cultural connectedness. I thought I was really, you know, kind of plugging into something on the tail end of it. It was though, clearly, its moment was passing. You know, Spy magazine had come up and was
yes.
kind of redefining how you did humor. But, it was a good time while it was there. I mean, it was a good time to leave. So.
It's too bad that that humor magazine style really has kind of fallen away, and that kind of satire. And maybe it is because, as you say, Feeding the Monster was so tough to do
mm-hmm.
on a monthly basis. And maybe, you know, and also, unfortunately, I think we're just less of a reading society, and maybe that has something to do with it as well.
Yeah, I think some of those, you know, I think websites have taken over. So, you know, if you want to sort of the quick hit for something funny, I think a lot of it's on the web. Of course, The Onion, The Onion's still fun.
Very true. That's a very good point.
A little tired, but and it's getting a little smaller, I think. But it's still, there's something still there. But yeah, it is more, you know, humor. Young humor writers are mostly going straight to TV at this point, it seems like. In fact, a lot of those, you know, guys coming up from Harvard and Yale, you know, from the college magazines,
mm-hmm.
used to be they would then go into something like the Lampoon and maybe find their way to TV. Now they all seem to be going straight into sitcom work.
Yeah.
I guess there's more job opportunity. Right.
Well, they were following that Algonquin Roundtable, I think, career mm-hmm. path of, you know, men of letters first before, you know, getting into movies and TV.
Yeah, like, yeah. Now it's just sort of a straight feeder system. Plus, I think the fact that TV seems to want younger and younger writers, at least on comedy there's a lot of, you know, 22-year-olds out there writing shows at this point, so they don't need to do the print phase anymore.
And that's why you have such brilliant comedies as Stacked.
Yeah. there you go. Yep. Great knowledge of the comedy traditions.
you mentioned in our emails that you've got a new book deal coming up.
Yeah. With Farrar, Straus, and Giroux is the publisher. It's a book called Mad Fortune, and it's going back to the 20s and 30s publishing world, but this is about the guys who created the confessional, the sort of the reality media, the first use of reality media, the True Story magazine, and also the whole kind of fitness, bodybuilding, softcore pornography world. A very strange ex-bodybuilder named Bernard McFadden, who became briefly the most successful publisher in America and then tried to become president and destroyed himself financially. But it is just a really fun American story of our peculiar madness and types of success. So it's shorter, quicker read than Men of Tomorrow, but covering some of the same, you know, the same cultural themes, but from very different, looking at it through very different people.
Will people like Charles Atlas then be part of that story?
Yeah, actually Atlas was a protege of this Bernard McFadden, so a lot of it is about the birth of the Charles Atlas world, the Charles Atlas, I don't want to say cult, but that strange confluence of nerdy boys and bodybuilders, and you know, which in a way the superhero came out of too.
Sure. No, that sounds great, man. Well, that's cool. Well, we'll look forward to that.
Yeah.
I appreciate your time today. I think this was a great conversation, and once again, Men of Tomorrow, please check it out. It's a great book, a great history of comic books from Gerard Jones.
Well, thanks for talking it up.
That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Word Balloon is a copyrighted feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2005.